Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hi there. I'm Rand Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Old friends David Diggs and Rafael Casal have been making things together for years. Poetry, music, funny YouTube clips. And in 2018, a movie, Blindspotting, that took the measure of police violence and gentrification in Oakland. Along the way, Diggs starred in Hamilton and both of them had to move away from the Bay Area. Now they're back with a new TV show set in the Blindspotting universe that's imaginative and conflicted, surreal and funny. Not unlike Oakland itself. That's all next on Forum, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. David Diggs and Rafael Casal's 2018 film, Blindspotting, centered on themes at the core of Oakland where it was set. Race and friendship, police violence, and gentrification. They've now expanded Blindspotting into a TV series on the Starz network, and the focus is broader. While tackling the prison system, Blindspotting's also a wild love letter to the Bay Area, all its contradictions and complexities, grounded in the stories of the community's women and the Thizzle Dance, of course.
Hello, everybody. Hi. I'd like to introduce you to the Thizzle Dance.
Thizzle Dance?
Thizzle Dance, I said. Can I do the Thizzle Dance?
And I'd like to introduce you to David Diggs and Rafael Casal, here to talk about their new TV show, Blindspotting. Welcome to Forum.
What's up?
I'm so excited to have you here. I wanted to have you as my very first show, but here we are. We're only a few shows in, and I mean this in the most sincere and complimentary way. This is actually a pretty weird and beautiful television show, and with all pieces of art like that, I have to ask, how did this get made?
Solid question. We were actually approached by Lionsgate after the film was out, who said, what do you think? Is there maybe a TV show adaptation of this? And we were like, nah, there's definitely not. It took us 10 years to make that movie, and we have other things to do with our lives. And we also told the story of Colin and Miles that was, we thought, necessary to tell.
For people who don't know that story, fill us in on that story.
Yeah, Blindspotting, the film, is about two best friends growing up in Oakland. One, Colin, is on the last few days of his probation for a violent crime that he committed, and living in a halfway home. On his way home one night, he witnesses the police shooting of an unarmed black man, and the story is about the next few days of their lives together, and how that event starts to challenge their friendship, the friendship between a black man and a white man who never had to come to terms with certain things before because they weren't as aware of the fear surrounding them. And it's also about a rapidly gentrifying Oakland that adds to the sort of pressure cooker of Colin's fears. Yeah. So that's what that film is about. And when given the opportunity to make a TV show, we realized that while making that film, one of the things we really always wanted more of was the character Ashley, played by Jasmine Sevis-Jones, we felt that she was representative of so many women that we grew up around. And the character that Jasmine created was so compelling, and we just didn't have enough space in a 90-minute film to get into anything really that was outside of Colin's perspective in order to pull off the trick of that film, which is to have everybody relate to and root for a convicted felon pointing a gun at a police officer, right? Like, that was it was a tricky thing to pull off, and we realized we really had to be inside Colin's head to pull it off.
And Raphael, what did the show end up being like? How does the show open? Where are we, a year in time ahead of the movie, or are we right after it ends?
We're coming in about 6 months after the events of the movie, and we're dropping into a really sort of a whiplash complicated scene where the first thing you're seeing is someone is being arrested. It's miles from the film, and Jasmine Cephas Jones' character Ashley is sort of coming home and witnessing this happening in real time. And I think it kind of gives the audience a bit of whiplash and wondering what exactly they're seeing. And the consequences of that arrest sort of play out for the rest of the first season.
Yeah. And let's hear Jasmine Cephas Jones in the first cut we've got of the sentencing, which kind of, you know, triggers the rest of the action of the show.
Everyone is about to go into shock, and I have to try to not. Bracing against the clock, knowing full well this crooked system is still crooked to the poor and brown, and he got half that down being from our block.
This is on for sentencing.
Now we wait for the number. His number, the countdown, the time I am bound around the hope we hound, the sliver of the light in the tunnel of the town, and repeat and repeatedly asked until found, when will he be out? Be out. Will he be out? Be out. Be out.
You will serve a period of 58 months in San Quentin State Penitentiary. Followed by 1 year of house arrest probation.
5 years.
So Miles gets sent away for 5 years. I think there's a couple different things I want to talk to you about this clip. Obviously, if you haven't seen the show, that doesn't sound like a lot of television. So David Diggs, like, you know, I know you guys came up in the spoken word scene. Did you think about just sort of going like, all right, no spoken word in this TV? We've been doing that for a long time. We're not going to do it. Why did you want to keep it in?
Well, it's one of the things about in trying to make a show that accurately represents the Bay Area, there is something inherently beautiful about the way that we speak there. And to me, the only way to get people to really hear it when you're not from where is there is to heighten the language. I actually think it's a particularly Bay Area thing to really point at this is how we sound to ourselves in our heads. It's beautiful. And so that to me is why verse is necessary to tell this particular Bay Area story. But it's also a useful tool, actually, particularly in 30 minutes of television. The thing we learned growing up writing short poems is that when you need to get a lot of information and emotion into something very quickly, you use verse. Metaphor is actually a really useful tool. And so is rhyme, and so is meter. It trains people's ears to hear the parts of the sentence that are important. And so it actually is really helpful when we have to cover a lot of ground, particularly emotional ground, very quickly.
Yeah. You do something else to cover emotional ground, too, which is, like, really, really interesting. And I'm not sure I've ever seen it before, which is you have these choreographed dancers who act as kind of this silent Greek chorus. Can you tell me a little bit more about that choreography?
Oh, yeah.
You can do it. Raphael can do it if you want.
This man just started cutting the grass in front of my house.
Got you. Me and Raphael are on Zoom looking at each other. The dancers are, for us, a representation of when people outside of prison are feeling the effects of the prison industrial complex. So that's sort of the loose rule as to when you see the dancers, but you're right that it allows it to be an extension of sort of emotional trauma and celebration. And we tasked our choreographers, Lil Buck and John Boogs, with infusing the choreography, who are incredible and really great with narrative. And that's why we wanted them. To infuse the choreography with as many touchstones of specifically Bay Area dance as possible. And so the style of dance that John does is actually born out of the Bay Area and out of Oakland specifically. And so that was useful for them. We also worked with the Turf Fiends a lot and a bunch of other local Bay Area dancers to really infuse, because there's a style of movement mm-hmm. there. So again, for me, like so much of the elements of storytelling go back to how do we tell a uniquely Bay Area story, even in the visual representation of it.
Yeah. Rafael, I know you're the showrunner, so I assume you had to deal with more of the logistics, like on the set, like figuring out, you know, these dancers are there. How do you actually, are you directing them? How does that actually work in a show like this?
I mean, you know, the answer is we didn't know. there isn't really a roadmap for a show like this. And then you throw a pandemic on top of it, and the limitations of how you can collaborate with other artists really sort of does. I mean, the reality is that like this was the epitome of the constraint is going to have to breed the creativity, because you know we're making a show that requires so much physicality in a period where you can't really rehearse in person very often, and so our relationship with Buck and Bugs luckily is one where David and I say all the time that our ship runs on enthusiasm. And so a lot of our, you know, a lot of our plan here was to, you know, come up with a moment where it felt like something could be communicated without language. A lot of times that's when David and I are writing and we realize that language is failing us and we need something else. And then going to Buck and Boogs, who are brilliant movement artists and understand storytelling through the body. And we would say, look, we think there is this moment that could communicate this. And we wondered if maybe it could, for example, in episode 4, could move through the house or could get everything, you know, all the moving boxes from the truck to the front door and in through the house. And this is their world. This is their language. And so they would start to sort of craft a movement piece and then show it to us. And then we would give a little feedback and, you know, we'd build with the other dancers. And a lot of that was really us sort of, you know, kicking back this idea of what does it mean to have these vignettes of movement throughout a television show. And it was really exciting to sort of figure out what that could possibly mean in a medium that we've very rarely ever seen anything like this before.
Yeah. You know, one of the surprises of the show is Helen Hunt is in it. And how did that come about? Because I don't associate her with like the Bay Area or the themes of the show, but she's amazing in it.
Yeah, I mean, Helen was a big supporter of the movie, so much so that she tweeted about it. She happened to tweet about it on a day where I was watching Twister for the first time in, I don't know, a decade. So that felt very serendipitous. And in her version of the story, she slid in my DMs. In my version of the story, I slid in her DMs. I don't know how this went. But you know, she was like, I'm a big fan of yours and David's in this movie. And I was like, I'm watching Twister. and she was very, like, very straight up about, like, we should know each other. We're, you know, I'm really interested in the kind of work that you're doing. And, I think David was out of town at the time. But I mean, it was like, yeah, cool. Let's get lunch, tomorrow or the next day. And I think, you know, within a few days we were hanging out and talking about possible ways that we could collaborate or the kind of art that we were most excited about making. And that was the beginning of a few years of a friendship. And eventually it landed in us asking Helen to be a part of this show.
That's so good. I'm talking with David Diggs and Rafael Casal about their new TV series, Blindspotting. And we want to hear from you. Has a member of your family gone to prison? And have you seen that experience represented well on the screen? And if you've seen the show, did you see yourself represented in a new way? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more Forum after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with David Diggs and Rafael Casal about their new TV series, Blindspotting. So a bunch of different times in the show and in a bunch of different ways, you're both trying, and the show as a whole is kind of trying to reckon with blackness and the varieties of the black experience in so many different ways. And we want to play a cut, which is kind of like a... Some of the characters of the show are essentially having like a round table talking about blackness. Let's hear it.
Your little beige self cannot tell me or qualify my blackness at all. So what's up with that?
Well, Nancy the same shade as me. Her grandmother is white. Does that make her any less black?
Uh-uh.
Does that make her less
You're
black?
You're talking about people granny like that?
Mama is old beige black, so that's hella different.
Old okay, beige. Full stop. First of all, not old. No, it makes sense. Like 40 years ago, would have been a little bit better, but Nancy still Rosa Parks black. Mm. You 2018 light skin. You know what I'm saying? You like...
Doja
Cat.
Oh,
how old do y'all think I am?
Hang on. Hey, hold up. Wait, y'all. You think I look like Doja Cat?
I mean, this scene is so interesting and so good. And I have a question for Raphael about it, which is, you're in the writer's room. You're the showrunner. There's a round table about blackness. Do you just sort of back out of the room and you're like, all right, I'll see you later. You guys figure it out. Or what do you do?
No, absolutely not. No, there's this paranoia about talking about experiences that are, you live in close proximity to, where people are like so afraid to be like, oh, I can't have a comment on this. I grew up around a ton of different communities. You have an opinion, you have observations. You know, it just like it has to be it's a group conversation. And so everyone is sort of in a safe space, you know, jumping in and saying, well, I've heard this opinion before, or this needs to be said, or, you know, well, what about this perspective on this? And we're having sort of a big collaborative. This is like, this would come up with the movie all the time. People would be like, oh, well, of course, David wrote all of his lines and you wrote all of your lines, because writers should only write their character's perspective. Like, what novels did you read growing up? Like, there would only be one character if you only wrote your own perspective. But I think we are like always trying to sort of foster an environment where we can have sort of these really transparent conversations about what we've heard and what we've seen come up and what feels like it's at the cutting edge of the dialogue. And then how does that turn into a, you know, what feels like a really organic conversation in the room? And that comes with, you know, concerns about where every writer's blind spots are. But I think that still affords a lot of space to go, well, what about this? Or what about this? And bring it to the room and see what happens.
I think the thing I love about that scene is that it allowed us an opportunity to keep the conversation very complicated, to not try to give any answers. Mm-hmm. And because we allowed each character to have a different perspective, it allowed for so much, you know, oftentimes in a writer's room, like you come up with 1,000 things and then maybe one thing is what it's about. This allowed for so many of the perspectives that everybody brought to the table to end up in the show and in conflict with each other. And that feels way more grounded to me. It feels way more like the versions of those conversations that I've had in my life. And then the interesting thing was getting on set and shooting that scene was kind of a trip, because there are a lot of things in the scene that are triggering to people, and like some of the actors would get into it. And part of the flow of that day was being like, hey, let's remember that for these characters, this isn't the first time that they've had this discussion or discussions like this, and they love each other already. We're starting from a place of love and care and respect. And so we can allow ourselves to enjoy the conversation. We can allow ourselves to have fun clowning each other and calling each other out and get angry and all of that. And it was a really kind of a beautiful, interesting experience that I had never seen on a set before.
Yeah. I guess one question I had about it was, were you worried at all about bringing what feels like kind of an in-group conversation to television? You know, because you know that it's going to be all kinds of people are going to see that conversation. Not only, you know, people who've never been exposed to that conversation before. And like, do you worry about that? Or do you think like it's good for white people in Duluth to like hear that?
I don't know that this is the first time that conversation's been on television at all. I think that the only sort of thing that we tried to do different was to not have it resolved with a bow on it. Mm-hmm. We just really wanted to present a conversation that didn't have a clear, winner or a clear like moral high ground that was coming from the writers of the thing who wanted to make a point. We really just wanted to portray a conversation sort of in the middle of where it was.
I think the hope is that this is one specific conversation between a very specific group of people, right? That we're showing off for the world. And I hope in its complexity we realize that like it is specific that you can't, I mean, a big part of the thing we're doing in that episode, right, is trying to poke holes in the idea of a black monolith. And so I think it's the diversity of perspectives that is important in that discussion, and what I hope, you know, leaves with people is that like these discussions do happen and there are safe spaces for black people to talk about being black with other black people. And not all of those conversations are going to sound the same. Only this one with these characters is going to ever sound like this.
Yeah. Yeah. It does that just so beautifully. I want to talk about Helen Hunt's sort of role as her character, Rainey. Rainey's role in the show. And I want to just play a cut first so people can kind of hear a little bit of Rainey.
Nancy keeps trying to sell me kente cloth, and I keep saying, Nancy, I can't wear those. And she says, you don't support black business. And I say, for f***ing sake, Nancy. And I buy 3 scarves. You want to talk about your visit?
Oh, I was in line at 6:30 this morning to make sure I was through security by 7:15, so there would be no way that we would miss our 7:30 appointment. And then they pushed it. So then I waited until 9, and then they pushed it again until 11, and then again until 3 p.m. And then they told me that visitation was done. Fuck. I don't know. Maybe I'll find another butt phone and call me tonight.
You guys say butt phone. Do you mean? You know what? I'm just going to be happy not being clear on what that is.
I mean, this is another scene in which there's these incredibly heavy elements, you know, just interaction with the carceral state. There's race. And it's also just like funny and human. And there's a specific version of whiteness that's allowed to sort of live in that space as well. Can you tell me a little bit more about like writing Rainey and creating that character? Like, who you knew people like this growing up in the Bay?
I knew you mean our moms.
Yeah.
There's like a white Bay Area hippie, like extremely liberal left alternative mother that I think, particularly in our generation and the following generation, had a lot of, right? The sort of this post-60s radical Bay Area lineage that gets sort of passed down, and that many of us are very different from our parents in that way because we grew up sort of in the, in the aftermath of that. We had our ideas of who Rainey was, but, you know, really we got to give a lot of credit to Helen because Helen came in and was like, you know, was read Rainey and said, I get kind of who she's trying to be, but clearly you don't have anyone in my age bracket in your writer's room. So I have some notes, you know, and she gave us notes on multiple drafts of the script, 3 or 4 drafts before she ever signed on to the project, just so we could dial in the voice of who Rainey was. And she really brought in a perspective that I think a lot of writers' rooms sort of suffer from, this where you have this massive age range in characters, but not necessarily a huge age range in the writer's room. And so I think we got very lucky that Helen is also a director and a writer. And we were very sort of open about the idea that she could contribute in any way that she wanted to sort of the motivations of Rainey's character in her motherhood, in her parenting, in sort of the place that she is in her life. And so I know Helen also had people in her life that she was basing Rainey on that are from people that are from the Bay Area that she's very close to. And then we sat her down with a few people in our lives so she could sort of study their speech pattern and ask questions about their motivations for how they navigate the East Bay and their place within it.
So good. We're talking with David Diggs and Raphael Casal about their new TV series, Blindspotting. And we want to hear from you. Has a member of your family gone to prison? And have you seen that experience represented well on the screen? And if you've seen the show, do you see yourself or your community represented in a new way? Get in touch on Twitter, on Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I want to talk a little bit about the Bay Area creative scene. You both have had to leave the Bay in order to sort of make your way in your careers. What's really missing from here that would allow people like yourself to kind of come back and make stuff at home?
Industry. I mean, you know, it is financial more than anything, I think. It's tough to make a living as an artist there.
Yeah.
But there is so much art being produced there. And I do credit like the art scene there for the kind of artist that I am. It was really interesting when I, you know, Rafa can attest to this a little bit too. Like there, I was doing Hamilton and like was getting all kinds of attention for things that were so table stakes for the way I grew up making art, you know. But there's a thing about when an artist from the Bay Area walks into a room and is given an opportunity to be just be that, that like people don't are there's something
like, what are you thinking? Like what's the table stakes stuff that you feel like Bay Area people have that some others don't?
For example, like having the fastest rap in the history of Broadway isn't a valid award, right? Because there are no raps in the history of Broadway, really. But and that is also a relatively slow rap for any rapper who grew up in the Bay. Like, so you know what I'm saying? We force ourselves to speed train because everybody there is good at it, right? And so things like that, things like being a kind of multi-hyphenate performer who's like very comfortable changing up the meter of a song in the middle of a song or like breaking a fourth wall or something. It's like fourth wall breaking stuff is like just part of basic theater etiquette in the Bay Area, right? So like I think there are things that we take as table stakes that are still new to a lot of the rest of the world, and that's what's really compelling to us about trying to figure out a way to bring a little more industry and more attention to the Bay, because I think we shouldn't always have to leave.
Yeah.
Also, the Bay is crazy expensive to live in.
That's also true.
Let's also acknowledge that.
Yeah. I mean, there is this. I mean, that very inequality and crazy extreme wealth is one of the things that kind of lends a surreal cast to this place, right? Which you guys really drive at in this show. Like, I feel like even more so than when you go into spoken word, there's these tiny little surreal moments, and one of them occurs like in the hotel. Ashley's been approached by this like just dirtbag trying to sleep with him, and the dancers are dressed in like the bellhop outfits, and there's just like the world kind of warps in this crazy way, and the dancers' bodies, you know, reflect this kind of, oh my God, like did that really just happen? Like is this racist, terrible, classist moment just occurred and the whole world is like warped, and then you like snap back to it and you're like, okay, back to work. Those moments, were those all written in? Or did you, as you were working with the dancers and the actors, just go like, actually, that was so racist. We gotta have a moment like that in here.
It's a little bit of both. There are moments where we specifically knew that there would be choreography and that we would use movement to articulate a shift in perspective for Ashley. I mean, the chorus really appears when the ramifications of the prison industrial complex are reaching out beyond sort of the walls of the prison and affecting one of our characters' lives. And that is really the first day that Ashley is really reconciling with how much her life has just changed and how much her perspective has changed on everything that's happening to her that day. I'm sure that was John and Buck's idea in that moment. I'm sure it was.
I think in the script, it was like a dance, like or something. Like there was a sentence that said, a dance happens.
Yeah, a dance happens that represents this, you know, and they turn it into this sort of like melting moment, which we then paired with Miles reappearing and having some commentary on it. And, Yeah, I think what's crazy about that moment is that was the second day of shooting.
Yeah.
We were still figuring out, like, what does this look like? How does the camera move during this? Like, how do we reveal it and then tuck it back away in a way that's going to feel, intuitive for an audience? And
Oh, man. I want to play one other cut. And the reason is, I feel like one of the things that's really beautiful about this show, particularly the secondary characters, are all allowed to have these incredible, like, inner lives. So let's play this cut here where we've got Janelle and Earl talking.
Another match. I swear, this town is such a... It's like somebody took a story about Oakland and tried to make it from memory. Like, some stuff is just way off.
Why'd you come back then? You was gone for 5 years. You must have had a whole other life.
It wasn't supposed to be 5 years. It just happened.
I'm gonna be out faster than your brother was after his probation. I'm trying to hit Europe or something. Marry some sexy ass, wee-weeing ass, French Mediterranean woman. Pop out a kid. Work on a fishing boat or something. I don't know. You ain't never won nothing like that?
I mean, I love this scene so much. And I feel like it's a key moment in the series.
It's fascinating what you think are curse words.
Well, yeah, it's true.
FCC. I love that scene too. I love that scene because I think there's great writing in it and really great acting.
Oh, so good.
Candace, Nicholas Lippman, and Benjamin Earl Turner are really putting on a clinic in that scene. I think it's really wonderful. I also particularly love that line about making Oakland from memory. Did you write that? I feel like that's a you line.
This feels like a me-ass line.
because that's also a comment on us. I mean, that's also...
That's the point. It's like, it is both like a comment on how the city feels when you revisit it and being unsure if your memory is betraying you or if the city has changed so drastically. Like, we have this weird sort of bird's eye view on the place that we grew up. And dropping back into the ground floor view is always so jarring.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of like wanted to talk about what it feels like to be in the Bay now and be like, this feels like someone is like satirizing the place that we grew up when we're there. And then also wanted to sort of like roast ourselves being outside of it now and writing back about home as being like, we are nostalgic for a thing that there's also a generation of kids now that don't even have that memory. Like, they've only existed in the transition.
Yeah.
And so there is this, like, you leave for 5 years and come back. That's the experience that we know the most about. It's like leaving and popping back in to see our family and friends and just being like, where did this whole street go? Where are these three venues that we went to all the time? There was this crazy thing in the paper the other day that was like, I tweeted about it. It was like, oh, the Uptown is under new management and locals are devastated. And I was like, what locals? The Uptown used to be the Black Box and then it became the Uptown. Right. And locals went, what the hell is the Uptown? What the hell is Uptown downtown Oakland?
Yeah.
And now there's a generation of gentrifying locals who are mad at the new gentrifiers for changing their gentrifying ass bar.
We're talking with David Diggs and Rafael Casal about their new TV series, Blind Spotting. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786, if you've got questions for them. We've had some trouble with the phones, but they're back up. 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more Forum after the break.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Here's what's coming up in our next hour of Forum with Mina Kim. Just in the past few months, foreign hacking groups have launched major ransomware attacks against U.S. private companies, including software provider Kaseya, meat processing company JBS, and Colonial Pipeline.
A recent Washington Post analysis found that ransomware attacks more than doubled from 2019 to 2020 in the U.S. We'll look at how and why these attacks occur and the national security threat they pose. To listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast, visit kqed.org/forum. And for the latest updates on our programs and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal, and I'm talking with David Diggs and Rafael Casal about their new TV series, Blindspotting, which is on Stars. I want to talk about code switching a little bit, because I think there's sort of like the basic idea of code switching, you know, like, hello, you know, I feel like I do it coming out of the break sort of, but there's, you know, there's these voices that we put on.
The NPR code switches.
Yeah.
That's a real thing.
And one of the funny things about it is in this show, you kind of go back and forth. There's an amazing scene, which I actually tried to get a cut from, but I wasn't sure that like people would get what was going on. There's like kind of Trish, who started trying to start a co-op strip club, which is also an amazing storyline in of itself, goes into the bank to try and get a loan. And there's a black bank officer. And so they kind of drop into the slang. And then at the end, basically, you know, he's been with her all along. And then he's like, no. So how did you think about that, the kind of many layers of code switching that people are doing in this show, you know, between the West and the East and Oakland and other things, you know, black and white. It's fascinating and more layered, I think, than we normally give code switching credit for.
I think we talk about Bay Area mouthpiece a lot. And what does it mean to be able to operate in a bunch of different circles? I think when we think of code switching in terms of like a national dialogue, I really do think about like the way in which people have to protect themselves in predominantly white spaces, and not sort of this broader idea of like, what does it mean to be in survival mode constantly and have a, you know, you could talk about Trisha's code switching also with her own mother. Mm-hmm. And like, what is her voice with her mom versus what is her voice with her friends in the same scene? And they're watching her code switch. It's not even like she's hiding it. I mean, Miles code switches in front of Ashley in the second scene of the first episode. He has like a way that he talks to his partner and a way that he talks to a security guard. Mm-hmm. And I think watching people navigate, you know, how they interface with the world based on who they're across from is something that, because the Bay has so many different communities sort of overlapping constantly, you sort of don't even notice the small variations of people's switches when they get around certain people, because I think there's a general understanding that like, this is the way in which you navigate like a massive sort of cross-cultural intersection in real time.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just interesting to see it represented in all of its like beautiful ornate mm-hmm. detail, you know?
Yeah. We also like don't make a thing about it. Like we know, there isn't really a moment where we're like, hey, you changed the way you talk. It's like, I think we're sort of the assumption that like,
of course you do.
I do that all the time. I do it all. I'm doing it with you right now. I don't really talk like this. especially if I've had a little bit of alcohol.
but that scene, I think the real function to that scene is to like, you know, demonstrate the inherent beauty of the code switch and of like how, you know, how much virtuosity there is in like two mm-hmm. people who speak this same version of a same language, and how much improvisation there is. You know, Lance, who plays Cuddy, you know, the great thing about him is that he's from there for real, and he can improvise in that world too, which is so, he can improvise in all that slang. That Uncle Sam don't even know the due date is one of my favorite lines. I'm pretty sure he came up with
that. Definitely improvised that. There's a thing I always think about in terms of people who are bilingual, and like you, if you walk up to somebody and you know they speak another language as their first language, you just switch over to that if you speak it. I think the Bear is the same way. Like if I know that you have access to all that vocabulary that like Trish and Cuddy, for example, like, you know, showcased in that scene, it's better language to articulate what you want to say. Like the shorthand works better. So the minute you have, you know, somebody has access to a vocabulary that you grew up speaking, I think that's what's beautiful about it is Trish is like, oh, you're like, what the shit? You, you're from here, you know, all right, let me explain this in a way that like you'll understand sort of the root of what I'm trying to navigate. And then they have to switch back to like, no, this is a bank. Like we have to talk in
right.
sort of corporate
this bank English.
Yes.
Yeah, we need to talk bank English.
right. We may be two black people in here, but it's a primarily white institution. Yeah.
Maybe not really alone. complicated.
The sort of deepest kind of heaviest storyline in this show, and it is very funny, but there's a lot of heaviness in the show. We got a comment, or Coco writes, I'm African-American and both of my brothers spent time in jail and prison. And what I don't see on television is the mental effects that prison has on a person. Both of my brothers suffer from anxiety and PTSD. They're never treated for it. Transitioning from prison to society requires an investment in each person leaving prison far beyond what exists today, thus the high recidivism rate. And I'll put the question I would put to you is this show really centers the people who the effects of the prison industrial complex on the people outside prison in having to provide that support for people who are on the inside.
There's this tweet that I saw this morning that was so perfect. I had to repost it, and it goes and it's by @esmiete. We're collectively joking about a year of quarantine ruining our social skills and ability to function in the regular world, but we just can't understand how people come out of prison after 5 or 10 or 20 years maladapted, or how incarceration only continues cycles of harm. And I think like there, what we're trying to do with the show as much as possible is show sort of how that system collectively impacts not only that person, or like this person is asking, their direct family members, but how those effects just last after incarceration is quote unquote over, and not only like systemically how it's holding on to you in every possible way and keeping you a convicted felon and limiting your ability to bounce back and have a career or have any real support around your mental health after you've been through a really, like, pretending that there's no reason to pretend that prison is not like an extremely traumatic, terrifying experience in itself. And so in a lot of ways, you know, Earl in our show is a bit of the representation of that in the same way that Colin was in the movie. And that like, and that's really, I think, why, and I don't know if Diggs, you want to jump in and talk about this more, but like, this is a big reason that we put Earl on this extension cord where he's always plugged in all the time, is to really, and by the way, and Diggs should tell the full version of the story, but like, we didn't make this up.
Yeah,
you know, like him being plugged into the wall all the time is both symbolic, but it's also like a thing that we really witnessed happening.
Yeah. That's based on a person who's very close to me and who was two things that we imbued in Earl. One, so terrified of being sent back for a technicality, and also smart enough to know that people get sent back for technicalities all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And has interacted with the system enough to realize that the system is actually a really basic, dumb system designed to pull people back because there's profit in that. And so that is it's like a shark. That's the only thing it can do. I find that extension cord hilarious, and it was when we were witnessing it, and also so sad, because it's super real, and that's definitely not made up. Like, it's a real story. We made the extension cord a little longer.
Yeah, right. That's the height you needed for art,
but
yeah.
not that much longer.
Yours
did it did go all the way from the backyard to the front door, like through the front
yard. We maybe added going to the corner.
Yeah,
but it definitely went all the way to the curb.
Yeah. Wow. Earl is really a beautiful character. I'm so happy to see Earl on television. Like, really. And as an actor, and it just the kind of brilliance, the kind of casual brilliance, you know, of Earl is just so great to see on the screen.
Benjamin Earl Turner.
Yeah. He's not actually an actor, right? I mean, by trade, he's like a musician.
No, he is. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. No, we've done a lot of plays together, and but he's a rapper. I don't know, like all of us, rapper first, I guess.
Rapper, poet, now screenwriter and television actor.
Yes, yeah. There it is. The hyphens. Let's bring in a call, Perrin from Oakland, born and raised in Oakland.
Hey, what's up, guys? Hey. I just wanted to tell a quick story and then ask a quick question. You know, the first day after I saw the movie, 3 years ago, I was on my way to work, and I was sitting at a red light in Adeline just waiting for like 10 minutes. And I was like, man, how relevant that was to the movie. And then like a Commander moving truck pulled up, and I just thought it was super awesome how relevant your guys' stories are and kind of get brought into, you know, our experiences living here in the city. And then my quick question is, yeah, I lived in Oregon for 9 years. I went there for college and then stayed after a little while. And if, you know, more recently come back, been back for 3 years. And, you know, one thing I took with me living in another place was like being super proud about being here. You know, you have it on your ID, you're born and raised here. And, you know, people are like, where are you from? You're from Oakland. And everyone's like, man, that's so cool or whatever. And like, they really have no knowledge of the city of Oakland. And so I guess my question for you guys is, you know, as you've, you know, moved on and in your life to other places, how have you brought your experience in the city of Oakland, and how is that, you know, how have you interacted with people when you kind of communicate, you know, where you're from and what you're all about?
I like to tell this story about David going to college. David, you know, in high school, like, wore a lot of pajama pants and berets and he
wait, pajama pants and berets? Those are two different categories of things.
Hold on. He looked dope. I'm not trying to hate. He looked tight. But
we don't have to lie. It was a weird kid.
It was an interesting vibe. It was very unique. And he rocked with everybody. And Diggs went to Brown, you know, on the East Coast. And I was like doing deaf poetry, and it opened up this recording studio. When David came back, a friend brought him through and was like, you need to mess with David because he's a rapper. And I think you'll really dig his stuff. And when David came through, David was like, bayed out head to toe, like, big bay t-shirt, you know, baggy jeans, like kicks that matched, a tie around his neck with a bandana and the frog. And I was like, oh, snap. And I think how we've always talked about it is like, when you leave, you know, and I lived in the Midwest for a couple of years. When you leave, man, like, your bay pride, you double and triple down on that thing.
Yeah.
There's this thing that the bro was just talking about like leaving and coming back and looking back on it. You do suddenly realize that, like, while you've lived in the nuance of the Bay for your whole life, nobody knows anything about it. And in making the show, this is the thing that, like, we have to come back to all the time, is like, we have to get people in France and Brazil and like all over the world to understand the essence of what it means to be from the Bay and grow up there. And so we're both juggling like hyper specificity for the local audience, but the mounting, you know, audience that we have to satisfy is this global, you know, Starz has like somewhat like 30 million subscribers or something. We have to satisfy this massive audience and then also get it right for local folks. And I think that's been the trip, is like, what are the precious things we have to get in that are hyper specific, and then what are the sort of feelings and essences of the place that we have to communicate and translate across continent and across languages?
Yeah. And what are you trying to communicate? You know, what's the goal? Like, you know, do I want people to be in love with this place or scared of this place or both? You know, like, there are good reasons for the whole gamut of ways you can feel about the Bay. And so it is a little bit of a trip starting to think of what you're doing, because this is different from our experience making the film, which was just like, oh, somebody's going to let us make something. Let's make it. Making this, there's a lot more awareness of that. Like, we're pushing this out into the world and people might actually see it. And so, like, the representation matters. And we do think a lot about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
I will say, though, just to jump on the back of that, like, we also did say really clearly when we started that we weren't trying to represent all of the Bay.
Right.
Like, we really were like, yo, we need to tell one small story really, really well. Mm-hmm. Because if, like, it's the same reason the movie's not called like Oakland Town. Because we can't, like, there's no small way to tell that big of a story. There's no way. And so really all we could do is like, all right, what's a story that we feel like we could tell with the writers that we know and love, that we think we could then bring in sort of the ways in which aspects of the city and the area, the Bay Area, like, can bleed into this story in ways that are intuitive and but can be tangible without being like, yeah, we're gonna represent this area and this experience and this one and this one, and like trying to have everything sort of mm-hmm. thrown in the pot and hoping it just comes out to quote unquote representation. Like, it's just, it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
But I was also kind of greedy for us as storytellers to be like, we got this, Barry. Like, yeah. You know, we were like, we're going to tell this one well, and then hopefully this one allows someone else to go, oh, you know what story they didn't tell? This one. I'm going to do that one. And someone else being like, you know which one they didn't tell? This one. I'm going to do that one.
Yeah.
Build it out.
I want to ask you a question about the Oaklands that are represented and aren't. But first, I want to play a cut of you doing some poetry, Rafa.
Raphael can't help but count the degrees of manipulation here that he's felt. Let me get this straight, he thinks to himself. Are they selling a drink to white America by trying to show that it's authentically Mexican? So that Mexican folks will drink and validate it, so that white folks will drink it thinking it makes them less white so they can attract exotic Mexican women? Who in the commercial are actually played by Spaniards, and in doing so pressuring Mexican women to look more European so that American men
I mean, this is relevant to me. I had a, you know, Mexican dad. My mom's from Massachusetts. And how do you think about your identity, Rafael?
Whoa, bro.
I went digging deep. I was in the crate. Yeah.
You play baby footage to Rafael and then be like, how do you think about your identity? That's the
call. You're gonna pull up a poem from when I'm 19 and then be like, how do you think about my identity? Bro, I think about my identity constantly.
That was amazing.
I haven't heard that poem in so long.
I mean, there's some beautiful things about that cut, though, right? The people that is the world that you came up in, right? You speak,
yeah,
and
I think what's amazing about the clip that you just pulled is right now in this country, there's a number of conversations about colorism in the Hispanic Latin American community, yeah, and really just the Latin community in general. And I think that is a section of a poem that tries to point at how little corporations know about the many different communities within that sort of quote unquote blanket community of Latinidad, which is a construct that a lot of people are deconstructing right now.
Yeah.
And so that's about sort of companies trying to target an audience that is not one audience or one experience, but is a massive multitude of so many different experiences. And I think in that moment, I'm just going like, so you think it's just A to B? You know, you think it's just this really simple, like, oh, I'm going to market it to this community by getting, you know, this ideal for them so they can get, you know.
I mean, it's a good point. I feel like one of the reasons why I wanted to play for you was I just feel like, you know, I think some older people think that like what we would have called woke in the old days, I don't know what we would call that now. Given that term has been, you know, changed so much, like there's some really necessary analysis that goes into that, and that, you know, a lot of these young poets were doing when you were 19.
And still are. I mean, I think the amazing thing about that poem is that was 15 years ago, and we're literally having the same conversation
exactly
right now. You know, I mean, like that's...
we're having it for like the first time now.
In terms of
public discourse,
right.
There was a very like niche conversation at the time that only a sect of that audience really understood. And that audience is actually a bunch of 14-year-olds in that clip. That's at Brave New Voices, where I'm like 19 or 20. I've just aged out of the competition and they brought me back to perform. But I'm super young. And I do think like there is this other thing that comes up a lot. I don't know that we ever directly address it in the show, though it is like omnipresent in the show, which is like, we are the kids of like hippie, hyper-political parents. And so there is both this like constant sense of awareness with all of the characters as they're walking through, you know, as they're walking through the world.
Yeah. We have been talking with David Diggs and Rafael Casal about their new TV series, Blindspotting. Thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, yeah. Stay tuned for more Forum with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.